if you score high on all three doshas, the common question is, I'm out of balance in all three doshas, which one should I focus on? The answer is focus on ama first. You won't be able to change the doshas until you reduce the ama. So in Ayurveda, it means you want to convert the situation from sama, which means with ama, to nirama, meaning without ama. So if you have vata sama, you want to convert it to vata nirama. Okay? So how do we do it? Well, one thing that we'd love to do is to simplify the diet. What we call it our ama-pacifying or ama-reducing diet. Very simple. You can remember it. Rice, dal, and vegetables. Rice, dal, and vegetables. So when someone is really toxic, let's say they've been severely abusing themselves with drugs and alcohol, or they've just gone through a really brutal chemotherapy program, or major surgery, or a big emotional turmoil, and they're just feeling dull and heavy and depressed, their digestion is off, their tongue is bad, then what you want to do is, for a period of even sometimes a couple weeks, put them on a very simplified diet. Make it easy for their Agni to digest what they need to digest. And the simplest things are rice, dal, mostly mung dal, and simple steamed vegetables. Then introduce some of the spices that we talked about. First the warming spices, then the hotter spices. Keep it very simple and have them practice the bits so that whatever they're eating, their body is able to metabolize. What happens then is as the Agni increases, it doesn't have to spend its energy digesting the chocolate cheesecake, but it can start digesting the accumulated ama. Now there are herbs that are useful to digest ama. Bitter herbs and pungent herbs. Bitter herbs are said to dry up the ama, and then the pungent herbs actually burn up the ama. So bitter herbs are mostly medicinal herbs. Aloe vera is a bitter herb that's widely available in the United States, and drinking aloe vera juice is something that we recommend commonly. The common Ayurvedic bitter herb is echinacea, which is quite bitter and has an ama-reducing effect. Echinacea. Every health food store promotes echinacea now for colds and flus. In Ayurveda, the bitter herbs, there's actually a whole formula called Mahatikta, which means great bitters. But the important ones are neem, which the Latin is Asadirachta indica. And there's a list of, I think, 20 or 25 Ayurvedic herbs at the back of your syllabus that goes over these. Neem is a very useful herb. It's available in most Indian food stores. And it's very bitter, and it has that effect of cleansing the system. The other one is Manjista. Manjista, the Latin is Rubia cordifolia. And that also is very cleansing to the system. So anything that's bitter, though, any bitter herb will have that effect of drying out the ama, because the bitter is composed of what two tastes? What two elements? Air and space. So it's drying. It will dry out the ama, which is thick and mushy and foul. And then what you want to do is cook it with pungent herbs. So ginger, cayenne, black pepper, spicy herbs, cloves, cinnamon. These are pungent herbs that will help to digest the ama. So next time you find yourself getting a cold, take some bitter herbs for a day. Drink some aloe vera juice. And then take a lot of pungent herbs. And you'll find yourself getting through that upper respiratory infection much more quickly. The other thing that's useful is liquid fasting, particularly if someone is kaphic. So we recommend juice and vegetable fasts, particularly if there's a lot of ama in the system, and the person's constitution can tolerate it. So if someone is at the end stages of AIDS and lost, 25 pounds, even though they have a lot of ama, they're not going to tolerate the fasting. But if someone has the muscle bulk and the body tissue to tolerate it, then a day of fasting can be very valuable. What we usually recommend is it starts after dinner. From that point on until the morning after the next, everything is taken in the form of a liquid. So lots of fresh water and ginger tea during the day, fresh squeezed vegetables and fruits, carrots, great, tomato, spinach, apple, just drinking throughout. If a person feels like they just need more bulk, then we recommend they make very thin vegetable soups, which they can actually blend up and it still will be primarily liquid, or mung dal, very loose mung dal. So it's really very liquidy. And by just doing that for a day or two, it really helps the ama to be reduced, the agnis to pick up again. Kapha types can do this about once a week. Pitta types maybe a couple times a month, and vata types occasionally, maybe once a month at most. But it's very useful, particularly if you've been through a real stressful time and now you can take a day or two to yourself. It's great to just simplify everything. Let yourself clear out. You shouldn't be doing this, though, while you have a big business meeting going on or a lot of other pressures. It should be a time of an inward stroke where, while you're fasting, you can take it quiet. Take a quiet day. Meditate extra. Go for walks in the park. Just be quiet so that your body can really release toxicity and doesn't have to process information from the environment. These are some of the common cleansing herbal foods that we use. Aloe vera we've talked about. Aloe vera is a really beautiful plant. One of its names in Sanskrit is Kumari, which means having the ability to act like a nursemaid. So it's very healing. We know how it works on the skin. There's different parts to the aloe vera plant. The part right underneath the skin is very laxative. So if you take that part, it's a very potent laxative, like senna or like castor oil or like cascara. But the inner part of it is actually very purifying and cleansing, and it's quite bitter. It's cleansing to the liver. It's particularly useful for the female tract. So for women who are having dysmenorrhea or PMS, women going through menopause, even for infertility, aloe vera is very cleansing to that whole system. Triple is the three fruits, amlaki, bibitaki, harataki, which are very balancing to the colon and also very cleansing. So when people are toxic, we often have them take triphala, a teaspoon a few times a day or a couple tablets a couple times a day. And it's very useful in cleansing, particularly the gastrointestinal system. Ginger, which comes in a variety of forms, has a name in Sanskrit as Vibhavasej, which means the universal medicine. And one of the reasons that it's described that way is that ginger works on all three phases of digestion. Remember, we mentioned dipan, pachana, analomana, digestion, absorption, elimination. And ginger acts on all three levels. So it enhances digestion, enhances absorption, and is mildly laxative. So it keeps things flowing through the digestive tract. It's very purifying. To make a tea out of it, just recommend grating up about a half of a teaspoon, putting it into a pint thermos bottle, and just sipping it throughout the day. So for people who have an ama pacifying program, we actually ask them to keep it with them. And throughout the day, every hour or so, just take a couple swallows of this hot ginger tea, which keeps them flushing through. We mentioned manjista and neem. These are classical Ayurvedic cleansing foods. Gugulu, it's Camphora muccal. It's this resin. It's one of the most powerful Ayurvedic herbs. It's readily available now. About five or six American herb companies are offering this through health food stores. It's useful in general detoxification. It's probably the most important herb for arthritis. Useful in diabetes. It lowers the blood cholesterol level. It's mildly laxative. So if you take Gugulu every day, your stools will get a little bit loose as this resin pulls toxins out of your system. Garlic is a complicated herb, and we know that it has rejuvenative value. Ayurveda doesn't use it that much because it's said that garlic has somewhat of a rajasic or tamasic effect on the mind. Remember, we talked about three principles of the mind, the gunas, the sattva, which is the creative, pure aspect, rajasic, which is more this transformational aspect, and then tamasic, which is this kind of stable or dull aspect. And so certain herbs like garlic, onions to a degree as well, are a little bit dulling to the mind, so that it's not used a lot because Ayurveda ultimately is a science of creating enlightenment. But for short periods of time, when someone is toxic or is having a lot of activity, a lot of vata imbalance, garlic is useful in that regard. And certainly from a Western medicine, we've recently understood that this allicin is a very powerful antioxidant and clearly beneficial in a variety of health concerns like cardiovascular disease. So let's move into this process of panchakarma. Panchakarma means the five actions. Pancha is Sanskrit for five. Karma, we know, is action. So in Ayurveda, there are these five intensive purifying procedures, which we don't use in their totality today. But we'll go through them. There's three stages to panchakarma. There's a preparatory phase, the principal phase, and then the post-procedure phase. And so in order to gain the full value of these elimination procedures, you've got to prepare the system for them. So we'll go through that. The preparatory phase, known as purva karma, consists of these two components, snehana and swedana. Snehana is another word for oleation, for oiling the system. And so Ayurveda makes a lot of use of oils, both on the skin as well as internally. And the reason is that, according to Ayurveda, ama, this toxic residue, is fat soluble. It's not that water soluble. So if you want to mobilize deep-rooted ama from the tissues, drinking a lot of fluid, liquid, is not going to get to it. But by using purified, herbalized oils, you can extract it from the tissues. So in Ayurveda, it's said that when you massage the body, that oil moves through the tissues, eventually ending up in the gastrointestinal system, and on the way, it's pulling ama out. If you take herbalized oils internally, sesame oil or herbalized ghee, it said it travels through the tissues, and as it travels through the tissues, it's extracting the ama. So oiling is valuable. In fact, massage in Ayurveda, although it's recognized how good it feels and all the other effects, it's really, in this process of panchakarma, is primarily a way to bring the oil into the body, which is always herbalized and always carrying these herbal substances through the tissues. The second aspect of the preparatory procedures is swedana. So our word sweat comes from the Sanskrit word sweden. And there's dozens of different procedures described to heat up the body, ranging from laying out in the sun, to going into a pit with hot rocks, to boxing, to running, to sitting in hot water. There's a number of different procedures. At the Chopra Center, we use several of these. We use a steam bath. We use wrapping people with hot towels and blankets. We use this wonderful hot oil treatment. And so these two procedures are said to prepare the system to eliminate the toxin. Snehana extracts the ama from the tissues. Swedana dilates the channels of circulation and allows for the ama to move into the shrotas so it can be eliminated. Same way that if you have olive oil that's been sitting in your cold pantry, doesn't flow very well. You heat it up, it flows more easily. It's said the same is true of ama. So these are the two preparatory procedures. These are the ways that we internally oleate people. Ghee is clarified butter. And in Ayurveda, ghee is considered a very nurturing, healing substance. Now, ghee is basically the essence of milk. It's the essence of butter, which is the essence of cream, which is the essence of milk. So the concern always is, well, what about cholesterol? So far, I haven't really seen a good study on ghee's effect on cholesterol levels. According to Ayurveda, by herbalizing it, it reduces its tendency to stay in the body and is really used as a media to carry the herbs through the tissues. If you look at the total amount of cholesterol in a teaspoon of ghee, it's something like 5 milligrams, which is a very low percentage of a daily intake. So when we recommend a little bit of ghee for people, it's useful in Vata and Pitta conditions. We're not concerned that we're suddenly going to bump their cholesterol levels up. During the panchakarma preparation, we actually have people take a lot of ghee, tablespoons every day for 5 days. If someone has a history of high cholesterol or coronary artery disease, then we don't use ghee. We go to one of the other ways of herbalizing the oil. The third thing that we use is sesame, and what we tend to do, and this seems to be now the most popular way of administering this, is we have people chew on sesame seeds. Sesame seeds are about 70% oil. So without having to drink sesame oil, which is not that pleasant, We have people chew on sesame seeds with some raisins, and it's actually delicious. And it has the same effect of oleating the internal system. You want enough so that you can actually see lubrication in the bowels. So we have people oleate for 5 to 7 days. And then again, there's lots of different ways to heat up the body. We tend to use these steam tents, herbalized oils, and then these heat wraps as the best way. But you can do this at home. You can do a massage and take a hot bath, and then you can take something, a gentle herbal laxative. Now, it doesn't have to be laxative, just some triphala, which will be ensuring that ama is pouring out of your system. If you think about, if you believe that the body holds on to toxicity, then how is it going to eliminate it? It's going to eliminate it through some type of opening. So it can either come out through the sweat glands, come out through the nose, come out through the mouth, come out through your urine, come out through your bowels. So the panchakarmas are really designed to enhance that process of natural elimination of the malas. We'll talk about these almost more from historical interest than from a real interest, because we're not using all of them. Vamana is the process of therapeutic emesis, therapeutic vomiting. Sounds pretty disgusting. How it's done is usually very gentle. You have someone drink a lot of tea, usually licorice tea, so your stomach is really quite full. And then you give a little tiny pinch of one of a number of these emetic herbs, like ipecac is something that we use here in the United States when someone has swallowed some poison and we think it's safe to have them vomit. And then in a very gentle way, these vomiting stimulants allow you to empty your stomach. Kapha is said to have a major site in the stomach. And so it's most classically used in people with severe kapha imbalances, like asthma or allergies. Our Ayurvedic consultants from India use it regularly and tell us that when they treat a patient, say a child with asthma, a few treatments of vamana, they can often completely eliminate their need for steroids or theophylline or inhalers for months at a time. It's not entirely foreign to us in the West, and we do tend to pull things out of people's stomachs when we think they're not eating very well. When you're really sick, often your body will allow you to vomit it up. Virechana means purgation, and we do use this regularly. It's particularly useful to help eliminate accumulated pitta from the physiology. So what we do is we have people oil internally, take a hot bath, and then take one of a number of gentle laxatives. Usually we use either castor oil or senna, but we sometimes use other ones as well. It's the most effective way, according to Ayurveda, of bringing out this excess fire from the system. It's quite a useful pitta pacifying process. If you're having problems with menstruation, every time a few days before your period, you get irritable and overheated, and then using a mild laxative, generally at the middle of the month, will often promptly reduce those symptoms. It's useful in people with migraines, particularly people who have migraines related to their periods, because the menstrual cycle is the way that a woman has of releasing pitta from her body. As we said, rakta, the blood element, is one of the strongest carriers of pitta in the physiology. So the reason that overall, if you had to plot pittas of men versus women, premenopausally, that men have more pitta than women is that Ayurveda says women have this opportunity every month to release some of the fire in their body. Once women go through menopause, they no longer have this opportunity, so that the risk of cardiovascular disease rises, which is a pitta disease. The risk of osteoporosis rises, which is a pitta vata disease. What's one of the common symptoms that women get at the time of menopause? Hot flashes, because they've lost the ability to eliminate that heat from their system. So in those times, bringing the heat out of the system will often reduce some of those symptoms. Okay, so that's virechana. Nasi is a way of treating head and neck problems. Nasi usually involves first a head and neck massage and then some herbalized oil drops into the nasal passages. And depending upon what you're treating, you can change the herb so that if someone has a vata problem and lots of headaches, you can use a vata pacifying herb. If someone has a lot of kapha problems and a lot of congestion and sinus problems, you can use a kapha pacifying herb. So it's a way of applying medicine to that area. We usually only use one or two drops of herbalized oil It's very helpful for people with recurrent allergies. In fact, a great simple home purification procedure that we recommend commonly for people with allergies is using a neti pot. A neti pot looks like a little tiny porcelain Aladdin's lamp. What you do is you fill this little pot with some warm salt water. There's the proportion. I think it's a quarter teaspoon per pot. And then you hold it up to your nose, and it clears out your nasal passages. You do it one side, then you hold it up, do the other side. And then after that, put a little bit of herbalized oil in your nostril. Just put it on your finger and sniff it up on either side. For people who have allergies, particularly environmental allergies, it often goes a long way toward reducing it. Because if you do it first thing in the morning, it clears out all the pollen or dust that you've accumulated all night as you've been snoring. So it cleans that out, and then the oil seems to have a protective effect on the inner lining of the mucous membranes. So even though the pollen is there, it's not triggering all the histamine responses. That's a simple thing that you can do using this nausea. Then everybody's favorite treatment is the use of Bosti. So we have a little bumper sticker you could buy at the store. It says, honk if you love Bosti. It's very quiet around the Chopra Center. Bostis are these herbalized enemas. It's said that one of the major sites of vata is the colon. And so if you want to treat vata, Bostis are the ways that are recommended. Now, from a Western perspective, there's usually some resistance to this at first. And so I've obviously been thinking about it for years. If you imagine being a doctor 1,000 years ago or 2,000 years ago, and you had a sick person and you wanted to get in medicines into that person, but they were perhaps too sick to take things orally, you know, we didn't have the ability to start an IV. It turns out that if you herbalize oils and apply them to the colonic mucus, it's a very efficient way of getting medicines into the system. So the colon is actually a fairly efficient way of applying medicinal substances. So you can put almost any therapeutic herb that you can take orally into a Bosti, or you use it as a purification process. It's not like colonics. Ayurveda, if anything, discourages this idea of putting gallons of water into the colon. It's usually very gentle, volumes of maybe as little as 80 cc's, a third of a cup, to 300 or 400 cc's. And there's a specific course of treatment that we use based upon whether or not it's Vata, Pitta, Kapha, what the primary concerns are. If someone is intolerant of Bostis, you can get a very similar effect by giving people the herbs orally, and it will eventually have the same elimination, purification effect. But if you read the classical literature, there's statements like 75 or 80% of all illness can be cured through the appropriate Bosti. There's one more, which almost nobody uses. It's called Rakta Mokshana, which is translated as bloodletting. Now, bloodletting, of course, has gotten a very bad rap in the West ever since we killed our first president with leeches. And yet, we actually use bloodletting a lot in Western medicine. Dialysis for kidney disease is really a form of bloodletting. Plasma exchange, which we use commonly in a variety of neurological diseases, is a form of bloodletting. There's two conditions, relatively common conditions, that we actually do take blood out of a person's body. One is polycythemia vera, which is a condition where you produce too many red cells, almost like the equivalent to leukemia, except it's red cell. And the other is hemochromatosis, where your body accumulates too much iron, and it causes eventual damage and cirrhosis of the liver. So, too much red cells and too much iron accumulation in the liver. What kind of diseases are those? Pitta diseases. And the treatment for both of those in Western medicine is regular removal of blood. So it's another example of how there's some consistent theoretical basis to even many of the modern treatments that we do, looked at from an Ayurvedic perspective. Occasionally, very occasionally, if someone has a very strong pitta constitution and they're just constantly getting one pitta aggravation after another, we'll suggest that they go ahead and give a pint at the blood bank. But there are herbs that have that similar effect. They're known as alteratives or blood cleansers. Again, aloe vera is one of the good ones. Most of the bitter herbs have a blood cleansing effect. And so we think about in terms of what can we do to clear toxicity out of rasa and rakta, out of the first two dhatus, plasma and blood. So we've talked about the three primary sites Kapha is mostly in the stomach. Pitta is in the small intestine. Vata is in the colon. So when we have people go through our full Panchakarma program, we do something to treat ama associated with vata and pitta and kapha. So we use nasya to help with the kapha. We use virechana to help with the pitta. We use bastis to help with the vata. Now, after someone has gone through this process of elimination, then we want to make certain that now that we've cleaned someone out, if their ama level has been reduced, we don't want them to immediately reaccumulate it. So this is where we go through this whole process of post-therapeutic interventions, known as pashat karma. First thing we want to do is gradually rekindle their agnis. So a very simplified diet for a day while we increase their spices is a very valuable thing. We have this little aperitif that we have all of our guests use, which is this combination of lemon juice, ginger juice, and a little bit of honey. It's actually quite delicious. It's spicy. We have people do that every day before they eat their meal to get the agnis kindled. So we have them keep a fairly simplified diet for a few days when they go home, and then gradually increase the complexity of that. Maintaining the good daily routine that Deepak talked about earlier is essential to keeping ama from accumulating. If you start staying up late, right away, eating your meals at strange times, not honoring your appetites, you're just going to get back into the same cycle. So after having gone through this cleansing process, we really encourage people to use it as a way of committing to a healthier lifestyle. Now, once someone has gone through a purification process, there are certain foods which are particularly nurturing and nourishing. Ayurveda talks about these as the four sattvic foods, the four pure foods: milk, ghee, almonds, and honey. Particularly if a person is relatively ama-free, we recommend that people take some of these four foods every day. A glass of milk a day, cook with a little bit of ghee, a few almonds a day, and using honey. They're just said to be very nourishing to the system at both a physical and a subtle body level. Daily oil massage, we've talked about how that really will keep the process going. So if you've gone through some purification, either a brief home purification or at a Ayurvedic center, then if you do that massage every day, you're going to keep that ama from reaccumulating in the tissues. Meditation, obviously, pranayama, and then really looking at relationships, making certain that you don't come out of this experience where you know yourself as spirit, you're feeling great about your life, and you immediately get back into a relationship where someone is a toxic influence of your life. So you will be stronger after going through purification, but you'll also be more sensitive. And if you're picking up things that are not that useful in your environment, it's really the greatest opportunity to change. Talk a little bit about rasayanas. You know this word rasa now. Rasa means the subtlest aspect. The first dhatu, rasa, this plasma. Rasayanas are foods that directly nourish the rasa. They improve the quality of the tissues. So they're not really foods in the sense of quantity. They're foods in the sense of changing the quality. And they're most effective, rasayanas are most effective after you've been through some purification. You know, if you're pretty toxic and you begin to ingest these very nourishing foods, they tend to be quite rich. So if there's already a blockage there, you're just going to keep piling it up behind the blockage. Once you've reduced the ama and the shrotas are clear, then the rasayanas are really able to go into the tissue layers and have a deeper effect. So these are some of the classic ones. Chavan prash is a paste, a jam made from amla, amlaki, which is Emblik Myrobalam. It's one of the three fruits in Triphala. It's the highest natural source of vitamin C on the planet Earth. It's about 10 times more potent carrier of vitamin C than oranges. And it has a long, literally a 5,000 year plus history of as a rejuvenative. Chavan prash is widely available in India, and every herbal company in India has its own little proprietary formula of chavan prash. If you read the original Charaka, you will see the full formula out there. This much amlaki, add this much ghee, this much honey, this much ashwagandha, this much shatavari, this much pipali. I mean, precise formula. And then everybody adds a little bit here or there so they can make it proprietary. The BioChavan is the IP product formulation of Chavan Prash, which we've tried to make so it's more palatable to Western tastes. You can either take it out of the can directly, jar directly, or you can mix it in some juice or some hot milk. So it's a rasayan. It's something that builds the tissues. It's good if you're depleted, but it's said to be a protector. Brahma rasayana is another commonly available one of these nutritives. Brahma is, it's actually, it's interesting, this herb Brahmi in India has been applied to several different plants. One of them in the United States we call Gotu Kola. But the one that really is Brahmi is another one called Sentinella Asiatica. But it's said to be one of the most purifying herbs for the mind in that it quiets but simultaneously clears. So it's very useful in students who are studying and people who use their minds a lot. And it actually, combined with other herbs, is very beneficial for people who are having insomnia because it just quiets. It creates that sense of awareness. It's very similar to the feeling of after you've done that vigorous pranayama where your mind is really quite quiet but very alert. So Brahma rasayana is another useful rejuvenative. Ashwagandha, which is now widely available in the United States, it's known as winter cherry. And it's said to be probably the most potent vitalizing herb in the Indian pharmacology. So that whenever someone is depleted, lack of energy, impotent, infertile, suffering with chronic fatigue, weakness in the nervous tissue, multiple sclerosis, ashwagandha is this very useful tonic which gets into the system quickly. And actually there have been several good studies recently. It's falling into the category of this new kind of modern herbal category of what's known as an adaptogen. Those of you who have studied herbs, you'll know this word, adaptogen, which means it makes you more resistant to stress. So if you take mice, and the classical stress for mice is you have them swim in a cage where they can't get out, and you measure stress hormones and immune function, when you give the mice ashwagandha in their food, they show less of a stress response. So people are taking a real interest in this now. Shatavari is also known as Indian asparagus. It's not like the asparagus that we eat, although it's in the same general family. It's asparagus racemosus. And it's said to be the most nurturing food for women. It's particularly useful for the reproductive tract and for breasts, so that almost every mother in India eats shatavari, takes shatavari when they're breastfeeding. It's said it increases the quality and the quantity of breast milk. It's useful, again, similar in some ways, although it's different in its qualities, but in its usefulness, it's similar to kumari, to aloe vera juice. So we use it commonly in women with menstrual irregularities, dysmenorrhea, functional infertility, moms who are breastfeeding. So it's a very useful, it's very nourishing food. Bala means immunity. It's one of the qualities of ojas. And it's also an herb. It's Siddha cordifolia. And it's very nurturing, and it's used in a similar way to ashwagandha and shatavari. It's a secondary rejuvenative, where when people are fatigued, generally low energy levels, it's very useful. So those are some of the common rasayanas. Now you can also look at rasayanas in terms of dosha. Rasayanas in general are subtler than the dosha, so it's hard to cause a problem with a rasayana. But if someone is really toxic, and you give them a lot of rasayana without first purifying them, they probably, at the very least, won't be able to use it. At the worst, it could actually make them more toxic because their body isn't capable of metabolizing this really nurturing substance. So for vatas, the rasayanas are ashwagandha, we mentioned, gugulu, you know now, which is the myrrh. Harataki, hara means to carry away. Harataki means that which carries disease away. Harataki is Chibuluk Myrobalam. It's one of the three fruits in Triphala. So Harataki is particularly useful for Vata. Ginseng, although it's not a classical Ayurvedic herb, it's very similar in many ways to Ashwagandha. Actually, there's another one called Vidara Kandi, which is sometimes known as Indian ginseng. Ginseng has very much rasayana effects. For Pitta Amlaki, again, it's this herb that makes up Chavan Prash. Amlaki means that which carries away ama. Saffron is a expensive but available herb, which is particularly beneficial for pittas. And aloe vera has a very cooling influence on the liver and in general. And then kapha, bibitaki is the third fruit. It's balearic myrobalm, and it has a resin effect on kapha. Gugulu, again, we've talked about. And pipali, which is this hot pepper, which has a purifying and nurturing effect on kapha. So we will use these more specifically for people based upon their dosha. Talk about the behavioral resinas. These are the classical first two steps on the Eightfold Path of Yoga, Yama and Niyama. And basically, if you know the seven spiritual laws of success and you practice them in your life, you are practicing the behavioral resinas, meaning how do we get nourishment at that deep level from our behaviors, from our relationships. So it's really quite simple. Ahimsa was really the prized concept of Mahatma Gandhi, nonviolence. And we all saw how powerful ahimsa can be. He got an entire invading force to leave the country without ever having to fire a shot. So, nonviolence, kindness to everything. Satya, practicing honesty and truth in your life. Asteya, kind of been traditionally translated as non-stealing. We see taking responsibility, not blaming other people for your situation, taking responsibility, seeing responsibility as the ability to have a creative response to any situation. Brahmacharya has generally been talked about as sexual continence. We think a more extended view of this is really what it means, which is to see Brahma, to see consciousness in everything that you do, to always be striving toward unity in your life. Apagraha means trying to not complicate your life, maintaining a level of simplicity. And the practices, Saukhya, just having clarity, not being rigid, but being true to yourself. Santosa, meaning accepting the present moment as it is, seeing what lesson there is to learn, and then making the choice. Tapas has often been talked about as austerity. Really what it means is part of the dharmic view of everybody is here to express their unique talents, to discover their highest self, and in that process to serve the rest of the world. Svadhyaya, study, just continuously deepening your understanding of life. And Ishvara Pradhana means striving towards your highest purpose. So if you practice the seven spiritual laws of success in your life, you'll really be absolutely practicing the best in the way of behavioral resinas.
This session is about biological rhythms. And when we're speaking of the qualities of spirit, one of them was that spirit manifests in cycles, in rhythms, and in seasons. The physical body of the spirit is the universe. And actually, if you look at that word, it means universe. It means one song. The very word universe implies the inherent rhythmicity or musical nature of existence, of life. So, only in the last few years have scientists begun to understand, although this has been something that has been known for thousands of years in Ayurveda, but in the last few years, scientists have begun to understand that our biological rhythms are in fact a mirror of cosmic rhythms, that what happens in the cosmos and the inherent rhythmicities that play themselves out in the cosmos also play themselves out in our biology as our biological rhythms. In fact, as a result of these discoveries in science over the last two decades, a whole new field of biology has emerged. And that field is known as chronobiology. Chronos means time. Biology, of course, is the science of life. So how does life function in relationship to time? And even though in the West, we've always had the notion that time is linear, in the Eastern theoretical frameworks, time has been regarded as the movement of consciousness which separates the observer from the observed. Time is manufactured when the self is sacrificed for the self-image, when the spirit is sacrificed for the ego, and from there on into its many diverse expressions in this process which is known as morphogenesis and differentiation. Time is the continuity of memory which uses the ego, the self-image, as the internal reference point, which is what separates the observer from the observed. In reality, the observer and the observed are one unified, dynamic field of existence and life where there is, in fact, no time. Past, present, and future are part of a continuum of consciousness that goes round and round in circles. And if there is an artifact of time, then that artifact expresses itself cyclically. Everything is a cycle. And so birth and death are part of the cycle. Now, from a strictly biological point of view, science is recognizing that you can give the same dose of a drug to a person at a certain time of the day or in a certain season, and it will have a different effect. Different types of food are metabolized differently. There are different responses to chemotherapy and radiation, different times of the day, different seasons. Your body is very different at 6 o'clock in the morning than it is at 6 in the evening. And this is at all levels, physical, biochemical, quantum mechanical, at the level of energy and information. You are indeed a completely different person, physiologically, biochemically, on the material level, on the psychological level, on the emotional level, and so on. All activities in the body have cycles upon cycles upon cycles. And as I said earlier, these cycles are a manifestation of cosmic cycles. So let's first examine some of these cosmic cycles. The first one is called the circadian rhythm in science, circadian rhythm. And this cycle comes about as a result of the earth spinning on its own axis. As the earth spins on its own axis, we have the cycle of the 24-hour day. And this cycle of the 24-hour day causes the circadian rhythm in the body. And circadian rhythms have been a subject of intense study by scientists for the last 3 or 4 decades. For example, early in the morning, if you measure somebody's cortisol levels, which is an adrenal hormone, it'll be extremely high. In the late afternoon, it'll be low. And there is a cyclicity to the secretion of cortisol, growth hormone, prolactin, etc., etc. In Ayurveda, it has been understood that that 24-hour cycle of the day can be divided into 6 distinct phases. And these 6 distinct phases have to do with the 3 principal modalities through which consciousness functions. And by now you know what they are: Vata, Pitta, and Kapha. So from 6 in the morning to 10 in the morning is a Kapha phase. That means, irrespective of your body type, from 6 in the morning to 10 in the morning, it doesn't matter if you're Vata, Pitta, or Kapha, for you, that will be a relatively hypometabolic phase. So, if you're Vata, of course, you're already hypermetabolic. The metabolism for you will come down by a little bit. And if you're a real Kapha, then your metabolism will slow down quite significantly. So, this obviously has some implications in terms of activity, in terms of diet, in terms of treatment of illnesses. This is a good time to exercise. Your body is hypometabolic, you need to mobilize it. If you're a Kapha body type, you have a tendency to gain weight easily. You're the kind of person who says, all I have to do is look at food and I start to gain weight, which is frequently a kapha complaint, then this is a good time not to eat. Or if you're going to take something, some nutritional supplements, this is a good time to take a kapha balancing herbal tea or some kapha balancing churna or powders or something like that. It's a good time for activity, good time for physical exercise. Kapha body types can do with a lot of extra physical activity, and it's also a good time to take, if anything, nutritional supplements that speed up the metabolism, that have the basic tastes of astringent, bitter and pungent. And it's also a good time for those people who need chemotherapy. And this is an important point that I want to make right now. How do chemotherapeutic drugs work? Well, most chemotherapeutic drugs, and for that matter, most antibiotics too, work by interfering with the replication at the level of the DNA. That's how a chemotherapeutic drug works. So the attack is at the cancer cell that's multiplying itself, and the multiplication, of course, occurs at the level of the DNA. And when you give somebody chemotherapy, your hope is that it's going to kill the cancer cell, which sometimes it does, but the drug being directed at DNA, directed at rapidly multiplying cells, is not selective. It kills anything that's multiplying rapidly. And what's multiplying rapidly in the human body? Well, a few cells are multiplying very rapidly. Cells in the skin, cells in the mucous membranes, cells in the stomach, cells in the hair follicles, cells in the gonads. That's why the dominant effects of chemotherapy, the side effects, are hair loss, ulceration of the skin, mucous membrane ulcerations, nausea, vomiting, impotence and sterility. These are the major side effects of chemotherapeutic drugs because they attack rapidly multiplying cells and not selectively. Therefore, if you give a drug in the kapha period, you're more likely to spare the normal cells because they're in a hypometabolic phase, and at the same time maximize the effect on the rapidly multiplying cells. Cancer cells are rapidly multiplying, but so are other body cells. Not all other body cells, but the ones I mentioned, hair follicles, skin cells, mucous membrane, gastrointestinal cells, etc. The difference is that your body cells, the normal cells, obey biological rhythms. They obey cosmic cycles. And cancer cells are renegade cells that have lost their dharma. This is a very interesting concept, which is an Ayurvedic concept. It says that the cancer cell is not in its dharma. Every cell in the body is in its dharma. Dharma means it has a purpose. The law of dharma, which says there's purpose in life. Okay? So each cell has a dharma. And the dharma comes from its memory of what it's supposed to do. A cancer cell is a renegade cell that has lost its memory of purpose. And because it's lost its dharma, it just is rampant. It's a rampantly violent cell that is just continuously multiplying, and it does not have any relationship to the cosmic cycles which other cells have. So it's always multiplying, whereas the other multiplying cells in the body go through these cycles of vata, pitta and kapha. So by knowing this, what you can do is you can select the drug to be given at a period when the body cells are obeying cosmic rhythms and the cancer cells are not. And now what happens is the drug then, given in the right dose, will selectively attack the cancer cells and spare the other cells in the body, giving you maximum therapeutic benefit and at the same time minimizing the toxicity. In fact, you can reduce the dose of the drug. So that's one very important insight that we have from Ayurveda based on the biological cycles. The approach to cancer from a strictly Ayurvedic perspective would not be a violent approach, because violence begets violence. It's a basic law of nature. And a chemotherapeutic approach is essentially a violent approach. And Veda says you do not use violence, even in threatening situations, unless as a last resort, unless it's the last thing you do, because you know that this is the only thing that's left to do. So what's the Ayurvedic approach to cancer? Not to kill the cell, not to be violent at the cell, but to try and restore its dharma, bring it back to its memory of who this cell is, what is its purpose. And how do you do that? Well, you create an environment in the body where every other cell is completely and totally in harmony with every other cell and with cosmic cycles. And that environment then reminds the renegade cell, this is how I should be behaving also. So you create balance in the body. You don't even attack the cancer cells. You create balance, as much balance as you can, as close to the state of least entropy. And then you are supposed to remind the cancer cell what its dharma is. Okay, so much about this first period, the kapha period. From 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. is the pitta cycle. And the pitta cycle is the cycle where your body is in this transformative phase. All the agnis, all the fire is at its heightened phase. The digestive agni, the enzymes, these are all the different aspects of pitta. So this is the period, 10 a.m. to 2 p.m., where metabolism and digestion are most effective. And therefore, Ayurveda recommends that this is the best time to eat a meal. And this is the big meal of the day, from 10 to 2, ideally speaking around 12 noon, if you eat your meal around then. And this is the meal that you must have access to all the six tastes. This meal will be digested the best and will be metabolized the best. From 2 o'clock to 6 p.m. is the Vata cycle. And during this Vata phase, what happens is that the body goes into a hypermetabolic phase again. And this is the time when there is, provided you're in balance, there's maximum mental clarity and there's maximum dexterity in your physical body. So this is the time to do mental work, creative work. From 6 p.m. to 10 p.m. is the second kapha cycle, begins again. It's like 6 a.m. to 10 a.m. and then again 6 p.m. to 10. And what happens is that your metabolic rate has gone up to its maximum peak and now it starts to decline again. And at 10 p.m. or so, it reaches its lowest point. 10 p.m. or so, your body reaches its lowest or nadir, what is called the nadir, the lowest point in its metabolic rate. Therefore, this is a time to start to wind down, to have recreation, to take it easy, and by 10 p.m. or maximum 10:30, to catch that low metabolic cycle, you'll have the best sleep if you fall asleep around 10 o'clock. The quality of sleep will be the best. Between 10 p.m. to 2 a.m., you start the second pitta cycle. So assuming you're asleep, then your agnis go to work again. Your metabolic fire goes up. Your digestive agnis, but also all the enzymatic activity is a function of pitta. So during this phase, what happens is that the body starts to renew itself. It starts to get rid of toxins. Renewal, rejuvenation occurs between 10 p.m. to 2 a.m. Now let's say you are a strong pitta body type and you happen to be awake during this time for whatever reason, out of habit or you have other things to do, then this is the time you are likely to raid the refrigerator. Because all that agni, which is supposed to be actually cleaning your body and getting rid of the toxins and transforming itself back to in a state of renewal, all that agni is active, you're awake, off you go and raid the refrigerator. So pitta body types who tend to stay up have the habit of binge eating at night, and they tend to get obese. Imbalanced pittas get obese because of this reason. And the treatment here is a pitta balancing that and going to bed at about 10 o'clock, 10:30 latest. Nothing else will work. You can give them all the kapha balancing supplements and churnas and teas. Nothing will work because it's not a kapha problem, it's a pitta problem. From 2 in the morning to 6 in the morning, you begin your second vata cycle. And this is the time that the body starts to increase its metabolic rate as well. And this is the time for rejuvenation of the subtle body. The rapid activity in this period in the morning also results in rapid eye movements, and this is the time that dreaming is most active. And according to Ayurveda, dreaming is very necessary to cleanse and detoxify and renew the subtle body. The physical body renews itself by getting rid of toxins, but so does the subtle body renew itself. And it does so through dreaming. So if there's any disturbance in this phase from 2 o'clock in the morning to 6 o'clock in the morning, then you're likely to get all kinds of psychological problems, depression, maybe other kinds of psychiatric problems as well. And what suppresses this cycle more than anything else is alcohol and sedatives and tranquilizers. So as a result, dreaming is interfered with. So you might take a sleeping pill and you think you had a good night's sleep, but actually when you wake up, you don't feel that fresh. And the reason you don't feel that fresh is that you have suppressed the vata cycle at night. And having suppressed the vata cycle, you have a build-up in your body of toxins in the subtle body. And in fact, one of the symptoms of withdrawal from heavy sedation or from heavy alcohol or from heavy ingestion of tranquilizers, one of the symptoms is what? Delirium tremens. That's an exaggerated vata experience, result of suppressed vata at night. In fact, people get hallucinations in the DTs, and the hallucinations are just those suppressed dreams that are manifesting now, even in the waking state. So that's the dynamics of that phase. If you measure biochemical activity during this cycle, you'll find this is from 2 to 6 a.m. is when all the hormones and all the neurotransmitters, cortisol, adrenaline, they start going up, 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 up. And your heart rate starts to go up a little bit during this time. Your blood pressure starts to creep up. And at 6 o'clock in the morning, it reaches its peak. So if you get up around this time, and you get up feeling really fresh, and you feel, wow, I'm ready to conquer the world. This is the 24-hour cycle, as nature plays itself out through our body. Now, if we were enlightened, and if we were totally aware of all that's happening in our body, we wouldn't need to know any of this, because all we would do is we would listen to our body's signals. And our body tells us, I'm hungry, and at 12 noon, I want this. Body tells us at 10 o'clock, this is the time to go to sleep. The body does this all for us. It's our interference with this that starts to cause this first disruption in biological rhythm. And the experience of that, the first disruption in biological rhythm, is a sense of fatigue. You just feel not so much energy. The second phase of that is you start to feel a little dis-ease and discomfort. This is the first stage of disease, really. And if you continue then to violate this cycle, then that will ultimately result in one of those manifestations of disease, whether it's a vata or a kapha or pitta problem, depends on which cycle, which phase of the cycle is disrupted. So one of the most common experiences that anyone knows what a disruption in a circadian rhythm would be, if you've traveled, then jet lag is a perfect example of a disruption in circadian rhythm. You take a flight from here, you can be in England in 6 hours, you suddenly put yourself in an environment where the cosmic rhythm is completely different from your biological rhythm. And yet, all you have to do is just be in that environment for a little while, and then your body starts to entrain again with the cosmic rhythm. Now, if you want to facilitate that process, then you would do what? During the flight, you would meditate. Why? When you meditate, then you go into the gap. And in the gap, actually, there is no rhythmic activity at all. It's the source of all the rhythms. So what you do is, in a sense, you suspend that. You go into a state of suspended animation. And when you get there, your body picks up the rhythm that's there as quickly as possible. Sleeping, meditation, not eating or fasting are ways to very quickly restore biological rhythms. If you're on a long flight, eat before you get on the flight. On the flight, drink lots of water, meditate, don't watch the movie, and when you get there, immediately fall into the cycle, that's the local cycle, which means eat when it's time to eat over there, sleep when it's time to sleep over there. If you work a night shift, then also your biological rhythm is likely to be disrupted. It's okay if you do that once in a while, but if you're doing that continuously, then no matter what anyone tells you, you know, no matter how much you sleep during the day, your biological rhythm is not going to fully adapt. And sooner or later, your body is going to protest in the form of some illness. So night shifts, even though they are an invention, remember, you know, the light bulb brought about the night shift. The light bulb, the invention of the night bulb brought about the night shift. And even though it's very, very healthy for the economy, perhaps, it certainly is not good for your physiological well-being. Okay, so that's a little bit about the circadian rhythm. I want to move to the other rhythms. So let's move to the second cycle. The second cycle is the cycle of the seasons. Again, it's a cosmic cycle. The earth goes around the sun, and as a result of that movement, we have the cycle of the seasons, particularly in temperate zones. So you have a seasonal cycle in your body as well. If you get depressed in winter, or if you fall in love in spring, the reason for that is a biochemical reason. And of course, nature orchestrates these biological rhythms with absolute exquisite coordination. The groundhog comes out of the earth, you know, it's going to be spring, the birds begin to migrate, the fish are going back to their spawning grounds. It's a whole symphony being orchestrated in nature. We're part of it. So the seasons affect us, the seasons in our lives. And winter, being cold and wet, is a kapha season. So if you're a kapha body type, you're more likely to have kapha problems, including things like congestive heart failure, which is a kapha situation, or edema, pedal edema, or cyclic edema, or types of arthritis which have a lot of fluid retention, or bronchial asthma, or bronchitis, sinusitis. These are all kapha aggravations that are more likely in winter, particularly if you happen to be a kapha body type. Summer, being hot and moist, is a pitta season and is more likely to cause inflammatory problems, especially if you are a pitta body type. So skin rashes, ulcers, inflammatory types of arthritis inflammatory bowel disease, inflammatory emotions, they all occur more frequently in pitta season and obviously in pitta body types. As you look across different cultures in the world, you find that in most geographical locations, you can actually identify the dominant dosha. So the dominant dosha in the United States is Vata. We have fast foods, fast lanes, fast relationships, fast everything, right? The average relationship lasts about as long as a video program. So we change our jobs fast. Everything is done fast. And actually, if you do a statistical kind of survey in the United States, you'll find that 70% of people are Vata body type. Now you go to the Middle East, and what's the dominant dosha? Pitta. Okay? Everything is hot. Hot tempers. All, you see all that turbulence, and it's like an emotional cauldron all the time. Okay. You go to Hawaii. Kapha. So you can see that even different cultures, they may show certain kinds of traits. It might help you to understand people a lot more if you knew why they were behaving in a certain way. So Pitta again, summer. And then autumn is a Vata cycle. And Vata problems include things like irritable bowel and migraine, headaches, and anxiety and restlessness and insomnia and tachycardias and palpitations of the heart are more likely to occur, particularly in Vata people during this time. Heart block, which is bradycardia, more likely to happen in Kapha body types than in Vata body types. So the moral of the story here is that you have to be aware of this, and knowing what your body type is, you have to make certain adjustments. You particularly have to pay attention to your daily activity, especially when you know that this is the season where I'm likely to get my bronchial asthma or my sinusitis or edema, then I should know why this is happening. I should take precautions that it doesn't happen by following a good daily routine, by taking the appropriate adjustments in terms of both nutrition and diet. A Kapha body type would want to be very careful about following a Kapha balancing diet, particularly in winter. And if you're a Pitta body type, then you want to be very careful of doing that, particularly in summer. Of course, if you're a mixed body type, let's say you're a Vata Pitta body type, then you're more likely to get Vata kinds of problems in autumn and Pitta kind of problems in summer. So you should be doing Pitta balancing program in summer, a Vata balancing program in autumn, and during the rest of the year paying attention to both. So this is actually, most of it is common sense, but as usual, it just because it's common sense doesn't mean that we're doing it. Finally, I just want to mention two other rhythms because they're part of the rhythms of the cosmos. The third rhythm is the lunar cycle. The lunar cycle occurs as a result of the Earth and the Moon and the Sun moving in relationship to each other. And the lunar cycle is about 28 days or so. And there are lunar rhythms in the body. Chronobiology is discovering this. That there are changes in the blood pressure, there are changes in the osmotic pressure, there are changes in prolactin levels that follow lunar cycles. What does this mean for practical purposes? I think it means that you should be aware of it, and if you're sensitive to it, you'll see that your moods might change, that your experience of the physical body may have a certain relationship to the lunar cycle. When I was a long time ago working in an emergency room, I used to moonlight, and depending on what the moon was, the experienced nurses in the emergency room would be able to tell the kinds of patients we would get that night. It's a full moon, we are going to get lots of people with congestive heart failure. Reason? Full moon is a Kapha period. It's the complete absence of the moon, we might get lots of patients with arrhythmias. Reason? Absence of the moon is a Vata period. somewhere in the middle is the pitta cycle. And you can see the correlations in terms of what happens in imbalanced people. If you're in balance, it doesn't matter. But if you're in imbalance, then that will precipitate the problem. And what creates imbalance? Disruption or violation of that natural law that's expressing itself through you. The other day I gave you a Western definition of stress. And I said stress is the perception of threat, physical or psychological. Now here's the Ayurvedic definition of stress. Stress is that which interferes with the spontaneous flow of nature's intelligence as it goes through our body. We are nature's intelligence, spirit. And anything that interferes with the spontaneous, effortless flow of this intelligence through our physiology is stress. Anything that is a violation of these natural, inherent rhythmicities of the spirit as it moves from unmanifest to manifest. Finally, the last rhythm is the rhythm that occurs as the result of the gravitational effects of the sun and the moon on the earth. And so what rhythm does that bring about? The ocean tides. And just there are ocean tides outside, there are tides in our own physiology. Because once upon a time, in our evolutionary history, we were in the ocean as well. And when we came out of the ocean, first as amphibians and then as mammalians, what we did it, we brought a lot of it along with us. And in fact, if you examine the body's fluids have exactly the same things that you find in the ocean. And even though we call this planet Earth, in reality, this is planet ocean. 80% of whatever exists is water. And inside your body, you have an ocean as well. And there are tidal rhythms that obey those cycles. The full tide is the Kapha period of the day. And the low tide is the Vata. In between is the Pitta phase. And actually, you can look at the newspaper, look at the tides. You'll be able to correlate that with this circadian cycle as well. Okay, so for practical purposes, what does this all mean? This means that if we were in perfect balance, that we were in the state of least entropy, then this kind of daily activity would really facilitate the state of least entropy. Entropy is what causes aging. Aging is the loss of this perfect state of balance. If you're constantly flowing with the tide, with the season, with the cycle of nature, then there is no entropy. Theoretically, you're in that perfect harmony. Because does the earth age? I mean, what's the difference between yesterday and today? As far as the earth is concerned, one spin. Is it fatigue for that reason? Well, the answer is no. And as the earth goes around the sun, keeps doing that again and again. It's just a cycle. And the entropy that we experience is because of a disruption of that cycle. So given that ideal state that you can think of, then this is what would be happening. Around 6 o'clock, you'd wake up, you'd brush your teeth, clean your tongue, drink warm water to encourage elimination, because elimination is perfect at this time. Empty your bowels and bladder, massage your body with oil, bathe, your exercise, yoga postures, meditation, eat breakfast, mid-morning walk. This is your activity from 6 to 8 in the morning, ideally. And around noon to 1 p.m., have your lunch, which would be the most important meal of the day. You'd sit quietly for 5 minutes after eating to let that be digested. Walk a little bit, and meditation late afternoon, preferably around 4:30, but definitely before sunset. And then dinner early, in the early phase of the Kapha cycle, so you don't want to catch it too late, and bedtime around 10:30. That's the ideal situation. Now people say, well, I can't do it, and the answer to that is, so be it. You can't do it. But this is what nature is telling us to do. Okay. And what it really requires is listening to your body. After a while it becomes natural. And then because you feel so good, then you can use the law of least effort, which is do less and accomplish more. And if you're in pure spirit, then the law of least effort says do nothing and accomplish everything. That's how the spirit works. It does nothing and accomplishes everything. Thank you very much.